supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have an especially fun question of the week for you this time around. The spice saffron is the most expensive spice in the world, but it grows on a unique fall blooming flower that many of you can cultivate in your own backyard. We'll tell you what it takes to grow your own saffron crocus when we get to the question of the week. Mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heaping helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Ken, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you today? Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being had, Ken. Where are you?
Right now I'm in Houston, Texas. I'm a commercial driver, but I call Norwalk, Ohio, my home. I have a few questions about a willow-type tree in my yard. It's about a little more than 40 feet tall, and it has some branches that come out 20 feet away from the main trunk. And what we're experiencing, we just bought the home, and the neighbors told us that the tree in the spring likes to really attract flies and bees to the point where it's hard for them to get in the yard. And the tree now has a foamy-like moss around the base and going up to some of the branches. It's like a green and dark green in some areas, and it has somewhat of like a moldy-like spotting, a white-gray spotting on that moss stuff. And I've never experienced a tree like this, or we don't know if there's a way to cure it if it's sick, or should we remove the tree?
So we got two different things going on here. A lot of willows do bloom very early in the spring. Any plant that blooms early in the spring has to be very clever to attract the right kind of pollinators. Now, these trees are all insect pollinated, these willow trees. Some trees are pollinated by the wind. They don't have to worry about this, but it is not unusual for flies to be the active pollinators of a plant. And of course, that's what bees do for a living. But if this is in the spring, even if that tree is covered in bees, I guarantee you could go up in a bucket right into the middle of a cloud of bees and you would never be stung. No one has ever reported being stung by these bees, have they?
No, they have not.
Because these are native bees. The bees that make honey are not native to this continent. They originally came from Africa. They spent a lot of time in Europe being cultivated. And now, of course, they're all over the globe. But they're not native, and they're Mediterranean, which means they don't like cold weather. They don't like wet weather. They don't enjoy winter time in their hives at all. So there are a lot of pollination jobs that honeybees just can't do. They're just not equipped for it. But every native plant in America has native bees and flies and crickets and beetles that come and pollinate it. But this should only be for a relatively brief period in the spring when the flowers are open. And then these creatures are ephemeral. They'll move on, and they won't be around anymore.
Ah, I see.
I'm more worried about the growth at the bottom of the plant. That does not seem right. Now, is this willow growing in the open? Is it crowded and shaded by other plants?
It's the dominant tree in our yard.
Good. And is it mulched with anything?
You know, there is a black mulch around the base.
Get rid of the black mulch and the mold will vanish. See, one of the problems is, especially with these, quote, black mulches, this is probably scrap wood that's been spray painted with God knows what. And all of these woods, whether they're triple premium shredded bark or whether they're ground up wood chips, they all keep things too moist, and they create many problems with molds and fungi. Just rake all that mulch away, pile it up somewhere, but get it out from underneath the tree. What I want you to do without disturbing the roots is get an old-fashioned hoe, a very sharp hoe, and just hoe away the grass. And ideally, to keep the tree as healthy as possible and to create a nice look, you would try to hoe it out in a circle at least a couple feet away from the trunk. And then this mossy stuff, this moldy stuff, is on the trunk of the tree and the wood, maybe?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Can you get a hose up there?
Yes, sir.
Just set the hose to a sharp spray. Just spray it off, and then take just a cotton cloth and just dry off the trunk of the tree. Try to keep the airflow going underneath that tree. Now, you will need to create some sort of a barrier underneath the tree to protect it from the encroachment of the grass and from mower damage. So I suggest you find a good source of yard waste compost, black compost. It'll be as black as that wood mulch you got rid of. And starting 6 inches out from the trunk, don't put any mulch directly underneath the trunk or touching the trunk. Starting 6 inches out, make a big, beautiful black circle underneath the tree, and you'll never have any kind of a mold problem under there again. And again, the flies and the bees, that is nature, baby. That's good for the trees, it's good for the flies and the bees, but they're not going to hang around, and those bees don't have stingers.
Well, thank you, Mike, so much. Thank you so much, and I will enjoy listening to your show from now until forever.
All right, Ken, thank you, sir. Drive safe.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Diane, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you.
Well, thank you, Diane. Where are you?
I am in South Bend, Indiana.
Very good. A pleasure to speak with you. What can we do for Diane in South Bend?
We live in a subdivision that was built fairly carefully into a wooded area, so we have lots of trees. And we have some poison ivy that has sprung up in two of our beds, and I will not use any sort of poison and anything that's been recommended. And I'm wondering if you can give me an idea of how I can eliminate that.
Oh, sure, and thank you, because one thing I like to try and remind our listeners is you can spray poison ivy with an herbicide, and it will appear to curl up and die, but then when you reach in and pull the dead plant, it still has all the oil that gives you the rash on it.
Okay.
Now, I'll tell you that the details are at our website. If you go to You Bet Your Garden and click on Garden Answers A to Z, under P, you will see what I'm about to tell you detailed in great detail. But years ago, I came up with a way to pull poison ivy that was perfectly safe and that made sure you would not be getting the rash over and over again. What happens is people pull poison ivy with gloves on, then they try to wash the gloves, but the oil remains, and then every time they touch the gloves, they get a rash again. Every time they touch something they touched on the way into the house wearing the gloves, they get the rash again. So this is an easy way to get rid of poison ivy without endangering yourself at all. Now, I'll begin by saying that if you are overly sensitive, poison ivy is a true allergy, but it's the only allergy that the majority of the human population reacts to. If you're one of the hypersensitive people, you should begin by going to a drugstore and buying a product called Ivy Block. It's a clay formulation you spread on your skin that gives you an extra layer of protection. But what you're going to do is you're going to get a rolling trash can. You're going to empty out that drawer or closet that has all those big, heavy plastic bags from the mall stores, and you're going to get a hose. You're going to go out to where the poison ivy is. You're going to lay the hose down right where the vine comes out of the ground. You're really going to saturate the soil. You pull a plastic bag on one hand. You pull a plastic bag on the other hand. you reach down with your plastic bag covered hands and you pull the vine out of the ground at the base slowly. You can't pull like a guy because it'll snap off. You got to pull slowly, and you'll be amazed. You may pull up a telephone line type root system that goes back maybe 20 feet and just keep wrapping it around your plastic bag covered hand with your other plastic bag covered hand. Then when you finally get the last root hairs to come out of the ground, you go to the rolling trash can and you just slide both bags and the vine into the trash can. Then you take fresh bags and you move on to the next vine. You never expose yourself to poison ivy. You never get the oil on anything you're going to touch again. The work goes fast, and you get rid of a lot of those old plastic bags that you've been swearing you're going to take to some place that claims to recycle them for 20 years now.
Okay, that sounds brilliant.
Yeah, well, every once in a while, Diane, you know, it's like the broken clock is right twice a day. I seem to have two good ideas a year and, you know, just kind of make sure I write them down real quickly now.
And I'm lucky I got one.
All right, Diane, good luck.
Thank you.
Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and plant more cool weather lovers that won't survive summer's heat, like peas, pansies, lettuce, and spinach, the crops that must have cool weather to produce well. And I'll put in some early potatoes, too, which grow well in both spring and summer. Most of all, I'll just be happy that we're out of the void and back into gardening season again. But don't you go filling your beds to the brim just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to grow your own almost priceless saffron. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden, made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee is a gardening resource featuring vegetables, flowers, videos, and more. The 2012 catalog is now available online at burpee.com.
You're listening to WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Fidelity Investments, Bucks County Investor Center, located at 1520 Main Street in the Valley Square Shopping Center. Information at 1-800-FIDELITY or fidelity.com. Fidelity Brokerage Services, member NYSE SIPC.
The WHYY forecast, scattered showers with a high of 52 degrees this afternoon. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of drizzle and a low near 39. It's 44 degrees in Center City at 1119.
Medford Lee's, a Quaker-related community for those age 55-plus and home of the Barton Arboretum, proudly supports WHYY. On April 14th at 11 a.m., it's their annual Arboretum Lecture, featuring horticulturalist and author David Culp. He will share how native plants harmonize with our natural environment and help create sustainable landscapes. Light lunch and arboretum tours follow the lecture. Information about this event and details about Medford Lee's communities at medfordlees.org.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I have to say I'm looking forward to the question of the week this time around. It is a topic that has always fascinated me, and I was thrilled to have the excuse to research it and remind myself of all the intricacies, and that is how to grow the very specific fall-blooming crocus that produces the incredibly valuable spice called saffron. And I'm told that fresh saffron is amazing compared to anything you can buy in the store. So we're going to tell you how to grow your own saffron later in the show. In the meantime, it's your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Sarah, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. This is Sarah in Oklahoma. How are you doing?
I am doing just fine. What part of Oklahoma? Norman? Oklahoma City?
Yeah, Oklahoma City, you got it.
What can we do for Sarah in OK?
My mom and I, we always like to do her flower beds at her house ourselves, and they're pretty big, and they're on a sprinkler system. Last year, she was thinking about doing mulch, you know, the colored mulches, and I heard you talking about this the other day, you know, the coloring is not really good, and we knew all that. And so I told my mom, you know, if you want a nice dark mulch, let's do cocoa shell. So she bought them, and we put them down, and we did about an inch or two. And, you know, they molded up. They blow around quite a bit. And somebody told us that the mold was normal. But I don't know. I think maybe part of the problem may be the sprinkler system. They're on a timed sprinkler system with the yard. So if the yard needs to be watered every day or every other day, so do the gardens.
Cocoa shell mulch is one of the best mulches you can have. The only people who we don't advise to use it are people whose dogs eat everything, because it does have some of the naturally occurring chemical compounds that are found in chocolate, which can be toxic to dogs. You are the first person I've heard of to get mold on your cocoa shells, or to say they're blowing around. But don't forget where you are, Sarah. You're in Oklahoma City. If you laid down on a flower bed, you would be blown around.
That's true.
Now, I'm telling you, your irrigation system is not doing you any favors anywhere on your property. No plants should be watered every day. You develop very weak, very shallow root systems, and sometimes you actually rot out the root systems of the plant. Do you have access to a control panel, or do you program it yourself?
Exactly, yeah. It's completely programmable.
And does it register when there's been rain in the area?
Not at all.
Yeah. See, that's one of the big dangers of these irrigation systems, is we've all seen them going full blast in a downpour. There are smart ones that have rain sensors, and I would advise anybody who's going to invest in one of these things not to bother unless it's going to be able to tell when it's rained or not, because they can really drown their landscape. Overwatering and frequent watering is a much bigger danger to plants than underwatering or maybe going an extra day without water. The wind that you experience modifies my advice. Were you anywhere else in the country, I would say 1 inch of water a week from your system delivered overnight, ending at dawn. But your winds are always wicking moisture out of the air. But you still have to encourage your plants to develop a good root system to protect them from your harsh climate, and especially to protect a lawn from the heat stress of summer. So you can break that up into two deep waterings a week. And it would be ideal, for instance, in terms of watering a flower bed, to have soaker hoses underneath the mulch. That's the way you automatically water a flower bed, is to have little rubber hoses that sweat or have little holes in them underneath the mulch. And then the water stays down, the top of the mulch stays dry, and there's no issue with any kind of mold problems.
Okay.
Chocolate is actually a natural mold inhibitor, so you're really keeping that area much too wet for the health of the mulch or the health of the plants. So cut back on the frequency, but water for longer periods of time, and that's also where you'll see plants that'll look good all summer long.
Okay, good to know. Well, thank you so much.
All right, my pleasure. You stay cool this summer.
Will do. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Rob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I have a cedar beehive company.
Okay.
And I sell my beehives all over the country, and a lot of my customers look to pollinate their gardens or their micro farms with honeybees. And I'm just wondering if you have any advice for me to pass along to my customers, that I can tell them what kind of other pollinators there are out there that will help them in their gardens and farms.
And where is your business located?
We're in southern New Jersey. We use Atlantic and Eastern white cedar for the beehives.
Okay, very good. Well, as you know, honeybees are originally from Africa. We're domesticated in Europe, and there's probably a beehive in every corner of the planet. They have covered the earth. But their roots, as you know, are truly African. They are really warm weather creatures. So honeybees do their best pollination in the middle of the season. it would be difficult for me to imagine honeybees doing really good work on my peach trees, for instance. Maybe this year because it warmed up so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But typically what I rely on for pollination of my really early plants are native bees. And the nice thing about native bees is they totally coexist with honeybees. I don't care what kind of crazy climate you live in. Every American has dozens to hundreds of different varieties of native bees. The diversity is enormous. Some of them are tiny. You know some of the huge ones like bumblebees, right, and carpenter bees. Some of them are almost invisible. Some of them look like flies. Some of them look like wasps. Some of them nest in holes in the ground. But one thing that all native bees have in common is they are exceptional pollinators. Native bees will come out in colder weather than honeybees will. They'll come out in wetter weather. They will fly at night where honeybees won't. Two things native bees won't do. One is sting you.
Right.
The male, and you know that honeybees can.
And oh, yes.
The other thing is, of course, native bees don't make honey.
Right.
So my idea of people who keep beehives is they're hoping to make some of their own honey, which to me is like analogous to growing your own garlic or tomatoes. And honeybees stinging is they are really unique almost in the bee world, in that, again, none of our native bees are going to sting you, but it is that latent aggression that is the honeybee's best hope. You must be dealing terribly with colony collapse disorder and keeping your hives healthy, and I'm sure you're following the scientific literature. And
sure.
Everybody remembers years ago there was these horror stories about Africanized bees, very aggressive bees that had escaped, or, you know, that these were different than docile honeybees. Well, it turns out these Africanized bees, these bees that have the aggression that they needed back in Africa to defend their honey colonies, they're probably the best hope for the world of honeybees, because these bees are not as prone to the mites and diseases that affect docile honeybees. There's something about the aggression that they're much better at fighting off these mites and cleaning themselves, and their immune systems are stronger. So there is a real upside to the aggression.
They also produce exceptional honey.
You mean the bees that have that wild trait in them?
The Africanized bees, their honey production is very high, but yes, they are more aggressive. So working with them is a little less appealing than some other breeds, but their honey production is very high.
But you know, that just shows they're the real deal, man. This is the real creature. This is not the family pet anymore. This is the tiger. And yes, there's a danger involved there, but everything else about it is better.
I would tend to agree with what you said. Sure.
And really, all they have to do to cultivate native bees is very much the same stuff they have to do to keep a hive healthy for you. No pesticides, and have a lot of things in flower at all times. You want native bees around, you start the season with witch hazel and you end it with fall blooming crocus. You have something in flower every time of the year.
Would you have any other suggestions for any other types of pollinators? I know hummingbirds are one, perhaps. Are there any other pollinators that we can attract?
Flies, crickets, beetles, butterflies. Anything that is attracted to the pollen and nectar on a plant and goes from flower to flower to get that little sugar rush is pollinating the plant. The world of invisible pollinators, so to speak, is massive. And I urge you, there's many great books on it. There's lots of great articles. The diversity will blow you away. Having a healthy garden will bring in pollinators, will give you a healthy garden, will bring in more pollinators. It's that whole essence of have a healthy garden full of life, and it'll look better than your neighbors.
Awesome.
All right, well, good luck with your business,
it.
And Don't forget, when you get stung, a little bit of Adolph's meat tenderizer right on the sting, and it'll denature that protein.
Ah, great. Point taken. Thanks, Mike.
Take care.
Thanks, you too. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Margie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
I am doing very well. Marge, how are you?
I'm doing very well, too.
And where is Margie doing well?
I'm doing well in Vineland, New Jersey.
A Vineland in the Garden State? Everything must grow sensationally for you.
Yes, yes, especially here in the southern part.
Very good. What can we do for Margie in our Garden State?
I'd like to know, what is the difference between pimento, red bell pepper, and paprika, and even red chili peppers? Can you tell me what the difference is between those things?
Actually, I can. Basically, what we're talking here is the large family of fruits that are all together known as the peppers. Now, okay, hot peppers are a category that has more of the spicy component in them, whereby sweet peppers lack that spice but are otherwise in the same family. The scientific name, capsaicin, actually refers more to the hot peppers, but they all share the same scientific name.
Okay.
Now, bell peppers are simply one type of sweet pepper. There are many shapes that sweet peppers can have. You've probably seen what are called Italian frying peppers, very elongated large peppers in farmers markets and supermarkets. But in reality, there is a whole world of sweet peppers beyond that. All different shapes, the diversity of the world of peppers is amazing. Now, one thing they all have in common: all green peppers are immature. All green peppers are not yet ripe. All green peppers will not, however, turn red. Some will turn yellow, some will turn orange, some will turn red, and there is a category of sweet pepper, mostly bell-shaped, but some other shapes, that turn a chocolate color when they're fully ripe. And if you've ever seen a purple pepper in the supermarket, that's actually an in-between stage. A lot of peppers will go through several color changes on the way to their final color. And there is a green pepper that turns purple and is often harvested at the purple stage, but if left alone, it's going to turn completely red. When these peppers reach their final stage, that's when they have the most flavor and nutrition. There's very little nutrition in a green pepper. Now, paprika is perhaps the most interesting pepper there is. In America, you can take any sweet red bell pepper, cut it up, dry it, grind it up, and the subsequent red powder can be called paprika.
Oh, okay.
But in Europe, this is made with a very specific pepper from Hungary called the paprika pepper that has just the slightest hint of a hot pepper in it. If you were to look at bell peppers as being zero on a hotness scale and habanero peppers as being 10 on a hotness scale, the paprika would be about a 1. It's mostly sweet, but it has that little chili pepper overtone to it that just gives it a little bit of bite. And in Europe, if you sell paprika, it has to be made from this paprika pepper. And you can actually find seeds of the true paprika pepper for sale from specialty seed growers, as can you find seeds for the true pimento pepper. The pimento pepper is a very thick-walled and meaty red bell pepper. It holds its color, it holds its structure well. And again, if you go into a specialty seed catalog, especially one that specializes in heirloom peppers and tomatoes and stuff, you can buy the true pimento pepper, and you'll have a variety of paprika peppers. And believe it or not, even though the climate there is cold, and these are long season plants, that paprika pepper and the spice itself was developed in Hungary. When these plants hit Europe, they became favorites in a very unlikely place because the growing season really isn't the best for growing these long season peppers. But the Hungarian people loved the taste. They loved the fact that they could dry it and grind it down and have this spice to use all winter long. So true paprika really does come from Hungary, and you can duplicate it perfectly by growing one of those Hungarian paprika peppers.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. It's very interesting.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. My pleasure. There's few things I love talking about more than peppers.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mike.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and start pruning my peach trees. Over the years, I've moderated my pruning advice so that I now reduce their size, open up their centers, and remove water sprouts and suckers just as the blooms are fading in the early spring instead of the dead of winter. This gets me out in nice weather as opposed to the finger-freezing kind and lets me enjoy every one of those beautiful peach flowers, which put apple blossoms to shame. But don't you go tidying up your trees just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fascinating phone calls and how you can grow your own saffron. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. For over 135 years, Burpee has provided gardeners with seeds and plants for everything from tomatoes to flowers to gourmet herbs. Online at burpee.com.
You're listening to WHYY-FM.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. The Delaware Master Gardeners will host a number of workshops at the University of Delaware's Newark campus. Growing tomatoes on Thursday, April 5th, composting on Saturday, April 7th, and growing vegetables in containers on Thursday, April 12th. You can learn all about the best magnolias for your home landscape at the Scott Arboretum of Swarthmore College on Saturday, April 14th at 10 a.m. The program is free, but pre-registration is required. And I will return to the Hamilton Township Public Library on Thursday, April 24th for an evening presentation at 7 p.m. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
The WHYY forecast, scattered showers with a high this afternoon of 52 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of drizzle and a low near 39. Tomorrow, mix of sun and clouds with a high around 61. Monday, mostly sunny with a high near 65 degrees. And Tuesday, partly sunny with a high around 67. It's 44 degrees in Center City at 1139. You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY-FM.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens, in just a little bit. We will get to the question of the week, revealing the secrets of the fall-blooming crocus that produces the priceless spice saffron, which almost all of you out there can grow yourself if you care to. Fresh picked saffron. It may not get any better than that. We'll tell you how to do it after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Frederick, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, how are you?
Very good, Frederick. How are you, sir?
Outstanding.
And where is Frederick standing out in?
Nacogdoches, Texas.
Okay, excellent. What can we do for Frederick in Texas?
Well, I heard you talking about termites the other day with another caller, and I thought, well, I'll go ahead and call in and ask about this type of pest. It's German cockroaches.
Okay.
Even though they are not native to Germany, they somehow have that name.
Right.
It has to do with the control of them, the extermination of them. You know, they seem to be very resilient.
No, man, these roaches, these German cockroaches, are some of the most supremely adapted organisms on the planet, like rats and mice. They are true pests of human civilization. They have evolved to live in conjunction with us and, of course, flip us out and make us think we're not good housekeepers and everything like that.
Exactly.
And actually, one of the first things you want to understand about them is they are creatures of moisture. A lot of times when there have been infestations in apartment buildings, what has lowered the level and sometimes even gotten rid of them is simply having a plumber go through every apartment and check underneath every sink and check every drain and make sure there are no leaks and no excessive moisture anywhere. In humid situations, you can get rid of the cockroaches by running a dehumidifier. They absolutely can't stand dry air, and they seek out areas of moisture. Yes, obviously they're going around looking for food, but I can assure you there is no correlation between having cockroaches and having a, quote, dirty house. There is a very strong correlation between having cockroaches and having a moist house and having some water leaks, even almost invisible ones underneath the sink. In some situations, you know how cold water pipes can sweat a lot. That's enough to really keep a cockroach colony very happy. So that's job number one. Fix all the leaks and reduce the moisture. And then, I think we may have even mentioned this old element that is used as an insecticide, probably in that discussion on termites you heard.
Yes, you did, and I have some, but it doesn't work.
Well, boric acid, to be used against termites, is not, it's used differently. It is used as a desiccant. It is used to dry them out. And then, of course, if they pass over this powder and it gets on them, not only does it kind of pierce them and reduce their water levels, but it slowly does poison them. So a lot of people will get these dry boric acid sprays and spray them into every crack and crevice. And then the other thing you would use is the old famous roach motel. You would put out baited traps, and in this case, you're not really using boric acid. The inside of the trap is sticky. The bait inside can either be food, or in advanced cases, I believe you can buy traps that are baited with pheromones, sex attractants. So the cockroaches go in thinking that they're going to have a good time, and of course, like that old ad says, they don't come out. So yeah. So it is a three-way process. It's fight every bit of humidity and moisture in your house. If none of your sinks are leaking, but your house is kind of on the humid side, run a dehumidifier. Spray that boric acid into every crack and crevice you can, and then put out a lot of sticky traps. And I would say even try different baits. Look for one with the pheromone bait, and then just put some food or whatever in some of the other ones. And once you really knock it down, and again, like the termites, once you build up a population that's carrying boric acid back to a common nest, you'll make a dent in them. But they are the most successful pest we fight against indoors.
Thank you so much, sir.
Fight the good fight. Don't give up. And before you know it, you'll turn on the light in the middle of the night and nothing will move.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck, man.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello?
Hello, Bob. How are you, sir?
I am very good.
And where is Bob Good?
He's 80 years old in Newcastle, Delaware.
What can we do for Bob in Newcastle?
Years ago, when I listened to you, I made raised beds, and I have at least 15 different raised beds, so so I don't have much lawn anymore. I'm in a development, but it's a good size. And in the pathways, I only have about 18 inches, and I have been putting my pruning twigs from the peach trees, the pear trees, and apple trees, and I've been putting them in the pathway. And then I was thinking, that's going to take nitrogen away from my plants that are in the bed, the raised beds. My raised beds are at least 12 inches, but today I was just out digging up the old, the deteriorated, and I said, maybe this is compost, so I've been pouring it back into the beds that were the pathways. But right now I have pathways that are bare, and I have a lot of twigs that my wife was kind enough to trim and put them in a, and I'm going to put them back in the pathways.
And it is my pleasure to tell you that you may continue to do so without any kind of fear. You are correct in that in some situations, gardeners can turn their gardens into a killing field by mixing uncomposted wood directly into the growing soil.
It's just in the pathways.
Right. A lot of people, for some reason, they get this idea that it'd be good to mix sawdust into their raised beds or to till wood chips or uncomposted leaves into their raised beds. And then they do get that kind of reverse nitrogen fixation where the wood that wants to decompose is seizing all the nitrogen in the soil. But when you've got raised beds with walking lanes in between, those walking lanes are the great place, are the perfect place for sawdust, for wood chips, for all sorts of wood trash. As you say, they're going to keep the weeds down. They're going to keep your feet from getting muddy. They're not going to affect the raised beds at all. And what you just described is something that I experienced joyously after I had had my own raised beds for about 5 years. I had filled them with a mixture of topsoil and compost and mushroom soil. And because we have a lot of tree trimmers come through the neighborhoods keeping the wires clear, I would always have a big pile of wood chips around, and I would use the wood chips to keep the weeds down in my walking lanes between my raised beds. And one year, just like you, I noticed, you know, these wood chips don't look like wood chips anymore. They look like really
dirt.
Good compost.
It looks like dirt.
So, exactly. So, about every 5 years or so, I harvest my lanes.
I had a second question. You said something about keeping termites away around. This was your last show I heard.
Right.
And you said treat the wood chips that you put in, or the wood. And I said, well, how do you treat it with boric acid? Do you soak it? How long do you soak it? And how do you treat the wood that you said put in these little things that you sink around the house?
Typically,
to get rid of termites.
I would never urge a homeowner to do this themselves. It's very easy for a homeowner to make their own boric acid ant bait, because you take the boric acid and you put it in solution in sugar water, and it's very easy to get the amounts correctly, whereby you know different woods absorb moisture at different levels, which is why there are professionally made what are called borate rods. These are wooden rods, wooden dowels that have been pre-treated to have just the right amount, because you want to make sure it's not so high a dose that the scouts die. They have to survive this little bit of boric acid and begin taking it back to the colony to get the queen. So the dose has to be so precise. This is the kind of wood that you would always want to buy, knowing that a professional had treated it just to the right amount to get it back to the colony and knock out those millions of termites.
Right. That sounds great.
All right, man?
Yeah, man, and it's been great listening to you over the years when I can catch you, and that's always good information.
Well, I hope you'll listen for many more, bud.
Okay, thank you.
Take care, sir.
Right, bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it is time to grow your own saffron. You Bet Your Garden producer Alexis Landis. We got a couple of questions this week asking about saffron. Read them off for us, would you?
Okay, Mike. We've got William from Dayton, Ohio, who writes, Mike, I would like to grow my own saffron. Will the plant that produces the spice Crocus sativus, commonly known as the saffron crocus, grow in the Dayton area? And what kind of sunlight do the plants require? We also got a letter from Charlotte in Parkersburg, Pennsylvania, who writes, We live at the border of Lancaster and Chester counties in Pennsylvania Dutch country. I'm from Sweden and love to cook with saffron around the holidays. A sweet saffron bread formed into traditional shapes is a big part of our Christmas tradition. Although I love the spice in any dish. I currently get my saffron from a local farmer's market, but we have early spring crocuses that grow like weeds in sunny spots on our lawn. Fragile white and purple flowers with fragrant dark yellow pistils. Because the pistils aren't red, I don't think they're the actual saffron crocus, which I believe grows in the fall, but they smell like saffron, and I'm wondering if I could use them for spice. Are these spring blooming plants the Pennsylvania Dutch saffron I've heard about? Or could they be poisonous?
Well, the flower that produces saffron is a true crocus, but it blooms in the fall, not the spring. In fact, it's one of the very last plants to bloom in most of the areas it's grown in the United States. Now, as William in Dayton correctly notes, its scientific name is Crocus sativus. And while most sources list its range as USDA growing zone 6 to 9, some say it can survive in the chilly zone 5, in which his Dayton, Ohio garden resides. Now, microclimate is going to be key, as a wet and shady Zone 7 garden is going to have more trouble growing this Mediterranean plant than a dry and sunny plot in Zone 5. Because as legendary bulb grower Brent Heath of Brent and Becky's Bulbs explains, the first requirement for growing your own saffron is good drainage. Soil that drains extremely well is an absolute necessity, he stresses. Our saffron crocus do best in rock garden-type situations. If you're planting them in regular garden soil, you should add a lot of sharp sand for drainage as well as compost for nutrition. Unamended heavy clay soil could kill these plants. As will excessive summertime wetness in any kind of soil, he adds, explaining that these plants are easily killed by what Brent likes to call, quote, the mindless daily irrigation systems that have unfortunately become very popular. Newly purchased bulbs, actually they're technically corms, will be shipped in the fall. Plant them in full sun and perfect raining soil as soon as they arrive, and they will typically flower that year. Each bulb should produce multiple flowers, and each flower will produce multiple pistils, the bright red thread-like female parts that provide the desired spice. You can pick the pistils off right there in the field, or pluck the entire flower and take it inside for processing. Either way, Brent assures us your fingers are going to turn bright orange. Carefully remove those pistils, allow them to dry gently but thoroughly, and then store the dried threads in a moisture-proof container until you're ready to use them. The leaves of the plants are going to stay green outdoors throughout the winter and should not be removed until they've lost all of their green color the following year. Then keep that area dry. The drier they are during their summer dormancy, the better. If all goes well, those flowers will reappear in October. As the underground bulb increases in size, so will the number of flowers. If you are lucky enough that the patch lives long enough to get crowded, you can divide them every 5 years or so after the leaves have turned yellow at the beginning of summer. Now about all these other crocus. Now about those other crocus. There are stories about the pistils of some spring-blooming crocus being used as a kind of a low-grade saffron, but I'm not going to tell anybody to eat anything I'm not sure about, which leads us to a very important warning. Most so-called fall-blooming crocus are actually members of a different plant genus known as colchicum, a type of lily that's the source of the anti-gout medication colchicine. These non-crocus, fall-blooming crocus, have six stamens instead of the true crocus's three. Some of these plants are also known as meadow saffron, which is really unfortunate, as all of these autumn so-called crocus are toxic. But Crocus sativus, the true saffron crocus, is perfectly safe. So if you're going to harvest saffron, grow only that specific bulb and no other fall blooming types. Oh, and quote, Pennsylvania Dutch saffron is simply saffron that's grown in the Lancaster County area of Pennsylvania, where an intrepid farmer has been cultivating the spice-producing flower for some years now. He was actually a guest on this very show back in 2005, and I'll post a link to a great New York Times article about him that includes lots of specific growing and drying tips. Well, that sure was some good information about growing your own saffron now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to pinch my pistols if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and perhaps check Foist to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems just like yours in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin Love Train Griffin. Our webmaster is Rich Banowitz. His faithful internet companion is Sarah Kazar. Fall blooming Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant, Amanda No Relation McGrath, is currently carousing with Crocus in Holland. Stuck here carousing with me is our editor, Al Banks. I'm the world's least expensive spice, Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. Are your boxwoods making too much noise? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss what causes boxwoods to snap, crackle, and pop, plus your fabulous phone calls.
You're listening to WHYY-FM.
WHYY is supported by the Philadelphia Museum of Art.